And in the U.S., presidential frontrunners are looking to land knockouts in the Northeast today. There's a growing alliance between Australia and Japan that suffered a serious blow, and the meaning of Deflategate. Yes, that's one of the stories on the mind of news analyst Neil Conan this week. He joins us, as he does most Tuesdays, from his MacNut farm on the Big Island. Seriously, Neil, Deflategate?
Hang on, you'll see.
Okay, all right. Let's start with the conventional stuff. Let's look at politics. Last week, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump posted victories in New York. Both are expected to do well again in the five northeastern states today. At long last, could this be the decisive day for both of them?
No, but for different reasons. The Democratic presidential race has actually been over for a while now. You could say Nevada or Florida and Ohio, but after New York, Secretary Clinton is certainly out of reach. Now, Senator Sanders' campaign has continued and will continue. It's fueled by enthusiasm and by money. All of those individual contributions allowed his campaign to outspend Clinton's by about 2-1 in New York, but all those ads and the big rallies and the fervent idealism added up to a 16-point loss. He's going to lose more ground today, and the only tactical question that remains is about how he decides to handle the transition eventually to concession and endorsement.
Which is not going to be easy, but you said tactical question. Is there a strategic question still out there for Senator Sanders?
Oh, yes, I think there is. And it involves what he always called his political revolution and what has to be crushing disappointment. He and his supporters came to believe this would happen in 2016, but the contest for the future of the progressive movement is not this year, but 4 years from now. Everybody's noticed that further down the ballot you go, the thinner the Democrats look. And I'm focusing on state legislatures here. Every 10 years, state legislatures redraw congressional district lines. So after a Republican wave election in 2010, we got a situation where the Democrats easily win more votes in congressional elections, but Republicans have a lock on the House of Representatives itself.
This is from gerrymandering?
Well, gerrymandering is what you call it when the other party does it. But yes, both parties draw those congressional lines for maximum partisan advantage. Ohio is a good example on the Republican side. Maryland is a good one for the Democrats. But 2020, that's a presidential election year when more Democrats will turn out to vote. And if Bernie Sanders can motivate his supporters to organize now to win state assembly and state Senate seats 4 years from now, that could change the political map for a decade at least.
Okay, but even if that happens, won't they just gerrymander for Democrats?
Well, they could. But there are models in Arizona and California of different, I'm not going to say nonpartisan actually, but less partisan ways to redraw the lines or change the process to make congressional races more competitive, make Congress more responsive. So there are real possibilities out there if the Sanders campaign can be the start of the hard work of actual politics and not just, you know, sort of a romantic failure.
Okay, all right. I'm going to leave that for a second, get back to today. And the other party, can Donald Trump land a knockout blow today?
Not today. He will likely go five for five today and pick up something like 100 pledged delegates. The knockout will come next week. Indiana is winner take all. Trump is leading there in the polls, but it will be the last stand of the Stop Trump movement. And if John Kasich and Ted Cruz can actually work together and swing that race to Cruz, they have a shot to hold Mr. Trump below the threshold for a first ballot nomination.
That seems to be a big if. I mean, right now that Kasich-Cruz alliance looks a little shaky.
Yes, and it's probably at least a month too late. If Trump wins Indiana, he becomes the presumptive nominee. California, New Jersey should put him over the top pretty easily.
And how about Republicans accepting him as a standard bearer? I mean, are they going to really rally around?
Some will, with varying degrees of enthusiasm. But a substantial fraction has already rejected Trump, either because they don't think he's a proper conservative, and by their lights he is not, but more because of the catalog of really hateful things he said about, you know, Mexicans and Muslims and women. They simply can't stand him.
He did give a rather restrained victory speech in New York last week, though, and then we heard that he would show his presidential demeanor from here on out. So how might that sync with his big speech on foreign policy tomorrow?
I don't think he can help himself when he gets in front of a crowd. You know, he'll probably read from a script in that foreign policy speech, and there might even be policies there. Who knows? But when he gets in front of a crowd at a rally, I think he reveals a part of his character that feeds on emotion. And he knows, as he said, every time the energy seems to, you know, flag a little bit, all he has to do is promise to, you know, build that wall. Nobody is ever going to forget what he's said so far and what he's promised to do. And I don't think he's going to be able to sustain what would, you know, be a veneer of respectability.
Okay, all right. We're going to move on to international news for a second. Now, today you reported in the Pacific News Minute about Australia's decision to award a huge submarine contract to France. And everybody thought that deal was going to go to Japan. What happened?
The Australians say this is just about technical issues. The French submarine is a superior product, they say. The French promised to build all of them in Australia. Jobs are a big part of it, and, you know, Australia has elections coming up. But there are big league politics here. The Australians may have burned a very important bridge with Japan.
So how much did Japan actually have invested in this deal?
Oh, quite a bit. Prime Minister Abe changed a fundamental interpretation of Japan's pacifist post-war constitution to allow the export of weapons. I mean, he did this expressly for the Australians. It was a very big deal. It cost him political capital. But more broadly, this deal was supposed to be the cement of a wider coalition between Australia, Japan, and the United States. Now that's up in the air. We're going to have to see how badly the Japanese respond to this. But, you know, it's not just a disappointment. You know, the Germans made a bid for the submarine contract, too. You know, you win some, you lose some from the Germans' point of view. For Japan, this is likely to be taken as an insult.
How big of an insult?
That's going to be determined. I'm not sure how they're going to react. It's particularly that they, you know, from their point of view, Prime Minister Abe went out on a limb for Australia in terms of, you know, changing the Constitution, the interpretation of the Constitution, something he wanted to do anyway. Maybe Australia can do something else, but right now almost all of the other major weapons contracts they have coming up are, you know, American weapon systems. And frankly, if the United States built a diesel electric submarine, it only builds nukes, the Australians would have bought that.
All right, we got to leave the serious stuff for a second. And I got to ask you about this because you promised Deflategate. You know, for those who forgot, this was the long, long saga of what happened to the footballs at the Patriots-Colts playoff game two seasons ago. So did celebrated quarterback Tom Brady of the Patriots actually instruct team employees to deflate the footballs to give them an advantage?
A league investigation found that he probably did. Other investigations poured some questions on it. But in any case, the NFL punished the Patriots. They don't have a first-round or a fourth-round pick in this week's upcoming draft. They were also fined $1 million. And then the league suspended Brady for four games. He took that to federal court and won. Yesterday, a federal appeals court overturned that ruling. Now Brady and the players' union have to decide whether they're going to take their case to the Supreme Court.
Wait. The Supreme Court? Are you kidding me? I mean, the violation here, if there indeed were one, has been compared to a speeding ticket. Doesn't the Supreme Court have better things to do?
Well, let's hope so. But, you know, there's a larger issue here. Football is simultaneously the most popular sport in the country, far and away, and it's also a deeply troubled institution. All the ongoing revelations about concussions and the way that, you know, day-to-day contact damages the brain puts us at a crossroad. We now know that playing this game in high school, in college, certainly in the pros, just playing the game is all too likely to lead to brain damage and, in too many cases, to early death. The larger implication of Deflategate is that the future of the game is likely going to be decided in the courts. There's, you know, going to be no way to escape our knowledge that schools and athletic conferences and professional leagues knowingly promote participation in a game they know to be dangerous. That's a liability nightmare, and it should be. If we can't resolve Deflategate outside of the courtroom, we're not going to be able to, you know, come to some agreement on how to reduce the violence in the game to make it safe or even safer without the courts winding up as the final arbiters.
You make a good argument. Thanks, Neil.
Thanks very much, Bethann. Talk to you next week.
You bet. We'll talk to you then. News analyst Neil Conan joins us on most Tuesdays from the farm. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio.